Antiquities, Book 6. A destruction of the Palestinians and their land through the wrath of God, on account of the ark taken captive by them, and how they sent it back to the Hebrews. B campaign of the Palestinians against them, and victory of the Hebrews under the generalship of the prophet Samuel. See how Samuel, weakened by old age, handed over the administration of affairs to his sons. D how, because they governed badly, the people in anger demanded to be ruled by a king. E. Samuel's indignation at this, and the appointment of a king for them, Saul by name, at God's command. F. Saul's campaign against the nation of the Ammonites, and victory and plunder of the enemy. G. How the Palestinians, having again taken the field against the Hebrews, were defeated. H. Saul's war against the Amalekites and victory. I. That when Saul transgressed the prophet's commands, Samuel secretly appointed another king, David by name, by God's commission. J. How the Palestinians again made war on the Hebrews, while Saul was still king. K. The single combat of David then against Goliath, the champion of the Palestinians, and the killing of Goliath and the defeat of the Palestinians. L. How Saul, admiring David's courage, gave him his daughter in marriage. M. That after this the king, having come to suspect David, was eager to kill him. And how David, though often in danger of death at Saul's hands, escaped, and though Saul twice fell into his power so that he might have killed him, David did not do so. O. How, when the Palestinians again took the field against the Hebrews were defeated in the battle, and their king Saul died fighting along with his sons. The book covers a span of 32 years. Having taken the ark of their enemies captive, as we said a little earlier, the Palestinians carried it to the city of Azotus and set it beside their own god. He was called Dagon, like some kind of spoil. The next day, at daybreak, when everyone went into the temple to worship the god, they found him lying before the ark. He had fallen from the pedestal on which he regularly stood. They picked him up and set him upright on it again, distressed at what had happened. But when they kept returning to Dagon and again found him lying in the same posture, prostrate before the ark, they fell into terrible perplexity and confusion. In the end, the divine visited destruction and disease upon the city of the Azotians and their land. They were dying of dysentery, a painful affliction bringing on a most excruciating death, worse than a natural release of the soul from the body. For they vomited up their own internal organs, eaten away, and utterly ruined by the disease. Meanwhile, the countryside was overrun by a plague of mice that came up out of the ground and destroyed both the crops and the fruit trees, sparing nothing. In the midst of these disasters, the people of Azotus, unable to bear their misfortunes any longer, understood that these things had come upon them from the ark, and that its capture and the victory that had brought it had not turned out to be a blessing. So they sent to the people of Ascalon, asking them to receive the ark among themselves. The Ascalonites did not find the request of the Azotians displeasing, and they granted them the favor. But once they had received the ark, they fell into the same terrible troubles, for the ark brought with it to those who received it from the Azotians the same afflictions the Azotians had suffered. So the Ascalonites in turn sent it on to others. Nor did it remain with them either, for driven by the same afflictions they passed it on to the neighboring cities. In this way, the ark made its way around the five cities of the Palestinians, exacting from each, as it were, a tribute for the visit it paid them, the very sufferings they endured on its account. Worn out by these evils, those who had experienced them, and a lesson to those who merely heard of them, resolved never again to receive the ark among themselves at such a price and such a cost. And from then on, they sought some device and means of ridding themselves of it. The rulers of the five cities, Gath, Ekron, Ascalon, and also Gaza and Azotus, came together to consider what should be done. At first, it seemed best to send the ark back to its own people, on the ground that God was championing it, and that the disasters had accompanied it and invaded their cities together with it. But there were some who said this should not be done, and that they should not be deceived into blaming the ark for their misfortunes, for it did not possess such power and strength on its own. God would never have allowed it, had he cared for it, to fall into human hands. They urged that the people remain calm and bear what had happened with patience, reckoning the cause of these things to be nothing other than nature itself, which, over the cycles of time, produces such changes in bodies, in the earth, in plants, and in everything composed of these elements. but the council of men who in earlier times had been trusted for their good sense and prudence, and who were regarded as such then above all, prevailed over the opinions just mentioned, as fitting the present circumstances. They said the ark should be neither sent away nor kept, but that 5 golden statues should be set up, one for each city, as a thank offering to God, because he had taken thought for their safety and had preserved them in life even while pursuing them with sufferings they could no longer withstand. And that they should also make an equal number of golden mice, matching those that had overrun and ruined the land. Then they should put these into a chest, place it on the ark, and build a new cart for it, yoking to it cows newly delivered of their calves. The calves themselves they should shut up and keep back, so that the cows, not hindered by following after their calves, would move all the more eagerly out of longing for them. Then, having driven the cows off pulling the ark, they should leave them at a crossroads and let them go whichever road they chose. If they went off toward the land of the Hebrews and went up into their country, that would show the ark was the cause of their troubles. But if they turned onto another road, they said, "We will pursue and recover it," since they would then know it had no such power at all. They judged that this had been well proposed and at once put the plan into effect. Having done as had been said, they drove the cart to the crossroads and, leaving it there, withdrew. The cows went straight ahead as if someone were leading them, and the rulers of the Palestinians followed to learn where they would stop and to whom they would come. Now there is a village of the tribe of Judah called Bethshemesh. To this the cows came, and when a large, fine plain opened before their path, they stopped, going no further, and halted the cart there. It was a sight for the people of the village, and they were filled with joy. For it was summer, harvest time, and everyone was out in the fields gathering in the crops. When they saw the ark, they were seized with delight, dropped their work at once, and ran straight to the cart. Taking down the ark and the chest that held the statues and the mice, they set them on a certain rock that was in the plain, and after offering a splendid sacrifice to God and feasting, they burned the cart and the cows whole as a burnt offering. When the rulers of the Palestinians saw this, they turned back. But the anger and wrath of God overtook 70 of the people of the village of Bethshemesh, who were not worthy to touch the ark for they were not priests, and who had approached it. He struck them down and killed them. The villagers mourned this suffering that had befallen their fellows and raised such lamentation as was fitting for a calamity sent by God, each bewailing his own dead. Declaring themselves unworthy to have the ark remain among them, they sent word to the community of the Hebrews, informing them that the ark had been given back by the Palestinians. When the Hebrews learned of this, they carried it off to Kiriath-Jearim, a city neighboring the village of Bethshemesh. There, a certain Levite named Abinadab, a man reputed for his righteousness and piety of life, took the ark into his house, as into a place befitting God, in which a righteous man dwelt. His sons cared for the ark and were in charge of this office for 20 years, for that was how long it remained at Kiriath-Jearim, having spent 4 months among the Palestinians. During that whole period, while the ark remained in the city of the men of Kiriath-Jearim, the entire people turned to prayers and sacrifices to God, showing much devotion and zeal toward him. The prophet Samuel, seeing their eagerness, thought it a fit moment to speak to men in this frame of mind about freedom and the blessings it brings, and he used words which he thought would best win over their minds and persuade them. "Men," he said, "for whom the Palestinian enemy is still a heavy burden, while God is beginning to grow gracious and friendly toward you, you must not only desire freedom, but also do what will bring it to you. It is not enough to wish to be rid of your masters while continuing to act in ways that will keep them in power over you. Instead, become righteous, cast wickedness out of your souls, and having purified them with your whole minds, turn to God and continue to honor him. For if you do this, good things will come to you, release from servitude and victory over your enemies, things that cannot be won by weapons or by bodily strength or by numbers of allies. For it is not to these that God promises to grant such things, but to those who are good and righteous. I myself stand surety for his promises." When he had said this, the people acclaimed him, pleased with his exhortation, and pledged to make themselves acceptable to God. Samuel then gathered them at a certain city called Mizpah, which, in the language of the Hebrews, means watchtower, and there, having drawn water, they poured it out as a libation to God, and after fasting the whole day, they turned to prayer. Their gathering there did not go unnoticed by the Palestinians. On learning of this assembly, they marched against the Hebrews with a large army and force, hoping to fall upon them while they neither expected nor were prepared for it. This news struck the Hebrews with terror and threw them into confusion and fear, and they ran to Samuel, saying that their spirits had sunk with fear and from their previous defeat, and that this was why they had kept quiet, so as not to stir up the enemy's forces. Yet even though you led us up to prayers and sacrifices and oaths, the enemy has marched against us while we are unarmed and defenseless. We have no other hope of safety than you alone, and God, entreated by you, to grant us escape from the Palestinians. Samuel urged them to take courage and promised that God would come to their aid. And taking a suckling lamb, he sacrificed it on behalf of the people and called on God to stretch out his right hand over them in the battle against the Palestinians and not to overlook them a second time in misfortune. God heard his prayers and, accepting the sacrifice with a kindly and allied disposition, granted them victory and mastery. While the sacrifice was still on the altar and had not yet been entirely consumed by the sacred flame, the enemy's force advanced out of their camp and drew up for battle, hoping for victory, since they supposed the Jews were caught helpless, having neither weapons nor having come there expecting battle. But they met with things that no one, however persuasively he had foretold them, would easily have believed. For first God threw them into confusion with an earthquake, shaking the ground beneath them and making it unstable and treacherous, so that as it heaved, the ground gave way under their footing, and where it split apart they were swallowed into some of the chasms. Then, thundering upon them and flashing blinding lightning around them as if to burn up their eyes and striking the weapons from their hands, he turned them, stripped of arms, to flight. Samuel then went out with the people, and after slaughtering many, pursued them as far as a place called Corias. There he set up a stone as a boundary marker of the victory and of the enemy's flight, calling it Strong, a symbol of the strength given them by God against their enemies. After that blow, they no longer made war on the Israelites but kept quiet, out of fear and the memory of what had happened. And the confidence the Palestinians had long held over the Hebrews now belonged, after this victory, to the Hebrews instead. Samuel led a campaign against them, killed many, utterly humbled their pride, and took back the territory which they had earlier seized from the Jews when they defeated them in battle territory that stretched all the way to the city of Ekron from the borders of Gath. At that time, what remained of the Canaanites was on friendly terms with the Israelites. The prophet Samuel, having set the people in order and restored a city to them, ordered that when they came together they should settle their disputes with one another there, while he himself went about the cities year by year, judged their cases, and administered good government for a long time. Afterward, weighed down by old age and hindered from carrying out his usual duties, he handed over the rule and leadership of the nation to his sons, of whom the elder was called Joel and the younger Abiah. He assigned the one to sit and judge in the city of Bethel, and divided the people who were to obey each between them, appointing the other to Beersheba. These two became a clear example and proof that some children do not turn out like the character of their parents, but sometimes prove themselves good and moderate though born of wicked ones, and at other times, as happened then, base though born of good ones. For turning aside from their father's practices and going down the opposite path, they let justice go for the sake of shameful gifts and gains, and render their judgments not according to truth but according to profit, inclining toward luxury and extravagant living. In this, they acted, first, in opposition to God, and second, to the prophet who was their father, a man who had shown great zeal and care that the people should be just. The people, angered at the outrages committed against the former order and constitution by the prophet's sons. The burden they placed on him, they ran to him. He was living in the city of Ramah, and told him of his son's lawless conduct, and said that he himself was now old and worn down by time and could no longer stand at the head of affairs in the same way. They begged and pleaded with him to appoint one of themselves as king, who would rule the nation and exact justice from the Philistines, who still owed them a reckoning for their earlier wrongs. These words distressed Samuel deeply, both because of his innate sense of justice and because of his hatred of kings. He was strongly devoted to aristocracy, believing it made those who lived under it godlike and blessed. Under the weight of anxiety and torment over what had been said, he took no thought for food or sleep, but spent the whole night turning over in his mind the questions these affairs raised. While he was in this state, God appeared to him and told him not to be troubled that the people had made this demand, since it was not him they meant to slight but themselves, in refusing to have God alone as their king. This, God said, was the very thing they had been scheming ever since the day he brought them out of Egypt. Before long, they would come to a painful repentance, from which nothing that was destined to happen would fail to occur. They would be shown to have acted with contempt and to have taken counsel that was ungrateful both toward God and toward Samuel's own prophetic office. I therefore command you to appoint for them whomever I designate as king, but first to warn them plainly what evils they will suffer under kingship, and to bear witness against the change they are so eager for. On hearing this, Samuel agreed to appoint them a king, and at dawn, he called the Judeans together and said that he must first describe to them what would come from kings and how many evils would befall them. Know that first they will tear your children away from you. Some they will make drive chariots, others they will make cavalry and bodyguards, others runners, commanders of 1,000, and commanders of 100. They will make some craftsmen, armorers, chariot builders, and makers of instruments of war, farmers and overseers of their own fields, and diggers in vineyards. And there is nothing they will not compel you to do, as though you were slaves bought with silver. Your daughters they will turn into perfumers, cooks, and bakers, and every task that maidservants perform under compulsion, fearing blows and torment, they will be made to perform. Your property they will seize and give to their eunuchs and bodyguards, and the herds of your flocks they will assign to their own men. In short, you will be enslaved with everything that is yours to the king, alongside his own servants. And when this happens, the memory of these words will come back to you, and suffering these things you will change your minds and beg God to have mercy on you and grant you swift release from your kings. But he will not receive your pleas. Instead, he will turn you away and let you pay the penalty for your own ill counsel. Yet even against these predictions of what was to come, the people proved thoughtless, and it was hard to dislodge from their minds a judgment already fixed there by their own reasoning. They paid no heed and took no account of Samuel's words, but pressed on stubbornly, insisting that a king be appointed at once and that no thought be given to the future. It was necessary, they said, to have someone to fight alongside them in taking vengeance on their enemies, and there was nothing strange in their wanting the same form of government as the neighboring peoples who had kings. Seeing that they were not turned aside even by what he had said, but persisted, Samuel said, "For now, each of you go home. I will summon you again when the need arises, once I learn from God whom he gives you as king." Now there was a man of the tribe of Benjamin, well-born and good in character, named Kish. He had a son who was a young man outstanding in appearance, great in stature, and superior in spirit and understanding to all who saw him. They called him Saul. This Kish, when some fine donkeys of his had strayed from pasture, for he took more delight in them than in any other of his possessions, sent his son together with one servant to search for the animals. When the young man had gone through his own tribal territory and reached the others without success, he had decided to turn back, so as not to leave his father any further cause for worry about him. But when the servant who was following him, as they came near the city of Ramah, said that there was a true prophet in that city and advised going to him, for they would learn from him the outcome of the matter of the donkeys. Saul said that if they went they would have nothing to give the prophet in exchange for his prophecy, since their provisions were now exhausted. When the servant said he had a quarter shekel on him and would give it, for in their ignorance they supposed the prophet took payment, they went on and, meeting near the gate some young women going out for water, asked them where the prophet's house was. The women told them and urged them to hurry before he took his place at dinner, for he was entertaining many guests, who would recline before he did. Samuel had in fact gathered many people to the feast that day for this reason. When he had begged God every day to tell him in advance whom he would make king, God had revealed to him the day before that he would send a young man from the tribe of Benjamin at just this hour. Samuel himself had been sitting on the rooftop awaiting the appointed time, and when it arrived, he came down and set out for the dinner. He met Saul, and God signaled to him that this was the one destined to rule. Saul approached Samuel, greeted him, and asked him to point out the prophet's house, saying that as a stranger he did not know it. When Samuel told him that he himself was the man, and led him toward the dinner, telling him also that the donkeys he had been sent to search for were safe and that every good thing had now been decreed for him, Saul, meeting this, said, "But I am unworthy of such a hope, my lord. My tribe is smaller than the others fit to produce kings, and my clan is lowlier than the rest. You are mocking me, making me a laughingstock, speaking of things too great for my station." But the prophet led him to the feast and seated him, along with his attendant, above the other guests, who numbered 70 in all, and ordered the servants to set before Saul the king's portion. When the hour for sleep came, the others rose and each went off to his own home, but Saul, with his servant, spent the night at the prophet's house. At daybreak Samuel roused him from his bed and set him on his way, and when they had come outside the city, he told the servant to go on ahead and had Saul remain behind, saying he had something to tell him with no one else present. So Saul sent his attendant off, and the prophet, taking the sacred oil, poured it over the young man's head, and kissing him said, "Know that you are king, appointed by God, against the Philistines, and for the defense of the Hebrews. And this shall be the sign I want you to know beforehand. When you leave here, you will come upon three men on the road going up to Bethel to worship God. The first you will see carrying three loaves, the second a kid, and the third will follow bearing a skin of wine. They will greet you warmly and give you two of the loaves, and you shall take them. From there, you will come to the place called Rachel's Tomb, where you will meet a man bringing you the good news that your donkeys are found. Then, going on from there to Jibba, you will fall in with a company of prophets, and being seized by the divine spirit, you will prophesy along with them, so that everyone who sees it will be astonished and amazed and will say, 'Where has this happened that the son of Kish has come to such fortune?' And when these signs have come to pass for you, know that God is with you. Greet your father and your kinsmen. You will come to me again, summoned to Gilgal, so that we may offer thank offerings to God for these things." Having said this and foretold these things, he sent the young man away, and everything happened to Saul just as Samuel had prophesied. When he came to the house of his kinsman Abner, for he loved him more than his other relatives, and Abner questioned him about his journey and all that had happened to him, he hid nothing else from him, neither that he had gone to Samuel the prophet, nor that Samuel had told him the donkeys were found. But about the kingship and everything connected with it, which he thought, if heard, would arouse only envy and disbelief, he said nothing to him, judging it neither safe nor wise to reveal it even to a man who seemed most devoted to him and was loved by him more than his own blood relatives. I think he reasoned about human nature as it truly is, that no one, not friend nor kinsman, keeps his good will firm even in the face of another's brightest gifts from God, but men grow malicious and envious in the presence of another's advancement. Samuel then called the people together at the city of Mizpah and addressed them, saying he spoke by God's command, that although God had given them freedom and had enslaved their enemies for them, they had forgotten his benefits, and they were voting God out of the kingship, not realizing how greatly it profits to be governed by the best of all beings. And God is the best of all, choosing instead to have a man as king, who will treat those under him as his own property, acting according to his own will, desire, and every other impulse of passion, indulging his power without restraint. Rather than laboring to preserve the human race as his own work and creation, the way God, precisely for that reason, cares for it. But since you have resolved on this, and your arrogance toward God has prevailed, take your places by tribes and clans and cast lots. When the Hebrews had done this, the lot fell to the tribe of Benjamin, and when that tribe was cast by lot, it fell to the clan called Matri. And when that clan was cast by lot man by man, it fell to Saul, son of Kish, to be king. But when the young man learned of this, he made himself scarce beforehand, not wishing, I think, to appear to accept the office willingly. He showed such self-restraint and moderation that, whereas most men cannot contain their joy even at small pieces of good fortune, but rush to make themselves known to everyone, he not only showed nothing of the kind at being declared king and made lord of nations so many and so great, but even hid himself from the sight of those who were to be ruled by him, and made them search for him and labor over it. While they were at a loss and anxious, since Saul had in fact vanished, the prophet implored God to show where he was and bring the young man into the open. Learning from God the place where Saul was hiding, he sent men to bring him, and when he arrived, Samuel set him in the midst of the assembly. He stood out above them all, and in height was every bit a king. The prophet said, "This is the man God has given you as king. See how he surpasses everyone and is worthy of the office." And when the people acclaimed the king with cries of "Long live the king," the prophet, having written down what was to come, read it aloud with the king listening, and placed the scroll in the tent of God as a testimony for later generations of what he had foretold. Having completed this, Samuel dismissed the assembly and went himself to the city of Ramah, which was his home. As Saul went off to Gibea, from which he came, many good men accompanied him, paying him the honor due a king, but more men of a base sort, who despised him and mocked him before the crowd, neither bringing gifts nor troubling themselves to please Saul in word or deed. A month later, the war against Nahash, king of the Ammonites, began the honor that all would eventually pay him. This man had done much harm to those Judeans settled across the Jordan, crossing over against them with a large and warlike army. He subdued their cities into slavery, overpowering them for the moment by force and violence, but also weakening them through cunning and calculation, so that even if they later revolted, they would be unable to escape servitude to him. For of those who came over to him under a pledge of good faith, or were taken by the law of war, he gouged out their right eyes. He did this so that, with their left eye covered by their shields, they would be entirely useless in battle. Having done this, the king of the Ammonites marched against the people across the Jordan called the Gileadites, and encamping before the chief city of his enemies, Jabesh, sent envoys to them demanding that they surrender at once, on condition that their right eyes be gouged out, or else he threatened to besiege them and raze their cities. The choice was theirs, whether they wished to give up some small part of the body or to perish altogether. Terrified, the men of Jabesh dared say nothing to either proposal, neither that they would surrender nor that they would fight, but asked for a truce of 7 days so that they might send envoys to their kinsmen and appeal to them for aid. If help came, they would fight, but if their situation proved hopeless, they said they would surrender themselves to suffer whatever he wished. Nahash, holding the multitude of the Gileadites and their answer in contempt, granted them the truce and permitted them to send to whomever they wished for allies. They at once sent messengers through every city to the Israelites, who reported Nahash's terms and the desperate straits in which they stood. The people, on hearing this, were moved to tears and grief over the plight of the men of Jabesh, and fear allowed them to do nothing more than this. When the messengers had come also to the city of Saul the king, and had told of the dangers the men of Jabesh faced, the people there suffered the same grief as the rest, for they mourned the calamity of their kinsmen. Saul, coming in from his work in the fields, found his fellow citizens in the city weeping, and asking the reason for their distress and dejection, learned that when he heard what the messengers reported, Saul was seized by divine inspiration. He sent the men of Jabesh away, promising that he would come to their relief on the third day and would defeat the enemy before sunrise, so that when the sun rose it would find them already victorious and free of their fears. He told a few of them to stay behind to guide the way. Wanting to frighten the people into hastening more eagerly to the war against the Ammonites, he cut the sinews of his own oxen and threatened to do the same to the oxen of anyone who did not come armed to the Jordan by the next day and follow him and Samuel the prophet wherever they should lead. Fearing the punishment he had announced, the people assembled at the appointed time, and he mustered the multitude at the city of Bezek. He found the number, apart from the tribe of Judah, to be 700,000 men gathered together, while that tribe alone numbered 70,000. Crossing the Jordan and covering a distance of 10 skoini in the course of a single night, he arrived before sunrise, divided his army into 3 companies, and fell upon the enemy suddenly from every side while they were off their guard. Joining battle, he killed many of the Ammonites, including their king Naas. This was a brilliant achievement for Saul, and it was reported to all the Hebrews, who praised him and admired him greatly for his courage. Even those who had earlier despised him now changed their minds, honoring him and judging him the best of all men. Not content with having merely saved the men of Jabesh, He also marched against the territory of the Ammonites, subdued the whole of it, and returned home in triumph with a great quantity of plunder. The people rejoiced at Saul's successes, glad that they had chosen such a man as king, and they shouted against those who had said he would be of no use to their affairs. "Where are those men now? Let them be punished." And everything else that a crowd, elated by good fortune, is fond of saying against those who had recently belittled the men responsible for it. Saul welcomed their goodwill and their zeal on his behalf, but he swore that he would allow none of his countrymen to be put to death that day. "For it was wrong," he said, "to stain a victory given by God with the blood and murder of kinsmen on a day that should be spent in celebration." Samuel then declared that Saul's kingship must be confirmed a second time by a fresh election, and everyone gathered at the city of Gilgal, for that is where he had told them to come. There, again in the sight of the assembled people, the prophet anointed Saul with the holy oil and proclaimed him king a second time. And so, the constitution of the Hebrews changed into a monarchy. Under Moses and his disciple Joshua, who served as commander, they had continued to live under an aristocracy. After Joshua's death, for 18 years in all, the people fell into anarchy. After that, they returned to their former constitution, giving authority to whoever seemed best in war and bravest in judging disputes among the whole people. And for this reason, they called that period of their government the Age of the Judges. Samuel the prophet then called the Hebrews together in assembly and said, "I swear to you by the greatest God, who brought those brothers into being, I mean Moses and Aaron, and rescued our fathers from the Egyptians and their slavery, granting them nothing out of favor toward myself, holding back nothing out of fear, and yielding to no other feeling that might have kept them silent. Tell me, if I have done anything base or unjust, or acted for gain or greed or favor toward others. Prove it, if I have ever taken so much as a calf or a sheep, which men think it no offense to take for food, or if I have ever seized anyone's beast of burden for my own use and wronged him by it. Declare any one of these things now, in the presence of your king." They cried out that none of this had been done by him, but that he had presided over the nation with holiness and justice. When Samuel had received this testimony from all of them, he said, "Since you have granted that you can say nothing improper about me, hear now what I have to say to you with all frankness. You have committed a great impiety against God in asking for a king. You ought to remember that our forefather Jacob came into Egypt because of famine with only 70 of our people, and that after many thousands had been born there, whom the Egyptians reduced to slavery and cruel outrage, God, in answer to our father's prayers, delivered the multitude from their distress without a king, sending them Moses and Aaron, brothers, who led you into this land which you now possess. Yet after enjoying all these benefits from God, you have betrayed your worship and piety toward him. Nevertheless, when you fell into the hands of your enemies, he freed you first from the Assyrians and their power, making you stronger than they were, and then giving you mastery over the Ammonites, the Moabites, and finally the Philistines. And you accomplished all this not under the leadership of a king, but under the command of Jephthah and Gideon. What madness, then, possessed you to flee from God and desire to be ruled by a king? I myself have appointed the man God chose. But so that I may make plain to you that God is angry and displeased at your choosing a monarchy, I will ask him to show you this clearly through signs, something none of you has ever before seen happen in this place, winter weather in the height of summer. I will ask God to grant you this now, so that you may know it." When Samuel had said this to the people, God signaled the truth of everything the prophet had said with thunder, lightning, and a fall of hail, so that they were struck with terror and overwhelmed with fear, confessed that they had sinned, and admitted that they had fallen into this through ignorance. And they begged the prophet, as a kind and gentle father, to make God favorable to them again and to forgive this sin, which they had committed on top of the other outrages and transgressions they had already perpetrated. He promised to entreat God on their behalf and to persuade him to pardon them for this, but he urged them to be just and good and always to remember the troubles that had befallen them for abandoning virtue, and to remember the signs of God and the legislation of Moses, if they desired safety and prosperity together with their king. But if they neglected these things, he told them, a great blow from God would come upon them and upon their king. Having prophesied these things to the Hebrews, Samuel dismissed them to their homes, having confirmed Saul's kingship a second time. Saul then chose from among the people about 3,000 men. Of these, he kept 2,000 with himself as a bodyguard and stayed in the city of Bethabo, while he gave the rest to his son Jonathan, sending him with them as his bodyguard to Geba. Jonathan besieged a Philistine garrison not far from Geba, for the Philistines, having subdued the Jews, had taken their weapons from them and occupied the strongest positions in the country with garrisons, and had forbidden them outright to carry or use iron. Because of this ban, whenever the farmers needed to repair one of their tools, a plowshare or a mattock or anything else useful for farming, they had to go to the Philistines to have it done. When the Philistines heard that their garrison had been destroyed, they were furious, regarding this contempt as a grave insult, and they marched against the Jews with 300,000 infantry, 30,000 chariots, and 6,000 cavalry. When they encamped near the city of Michmash, Saul, king of the Jews, learned of it and went down to the city of Gilgal, and proclaimed throughout the whole country a call to the people to fight for their freedom against the Philistines, belittling their strength and dismissing it as not worth fearing or risking danger over. But when Saul's men saw the size of the Philistine force, they were terrified. Some hid themselves in caves and underground passages, while most fled across the Jordan into the territory of Gad and Reuben. Saul sent for the prophet, summoning him to consult together about the war and the situation. Samuel told him to wait there and prepare sacrificial victims, for he would come to him after 7 days, so that they might sacrifice on the seventh day and only then join battle with the enemy. Saul waited as the prophet had instructed, but he did not keep to the command fully. When he saw that the prophet was delayed and that his soldiers were deserting him, he took the victims and performed the sacrifice himself. Just as he finished, he heard that Samuel was approaching and went out to meet him. Samuel told him he had not acted rightly in disregarding his instructions and anticipating his arrival, which was meant to take place according to God's will, in connection with the prayers and sacrifices offered on behalf of the people. Saul, he said, had usurped this by performing the sacrifice improperly and acting rashly. Saul defended himself, saying that he had waited the appointed number of days, but that necessity had driven him to hasten the sacrifice. His soldiers were deserting out of fear, the enemy was encamped at Michmash, and he had heard that they were coming down against him at Gilgal. Samuel replied, "But if you had been righteous and had not disobeyed me, nor made light of what God instructed me concerning the present situation, acting more hastily than the circumstances warranted, you would have reigned for a very long time, both you and your descendants." And Samuel, grieved at what had happened, withdrew to his own home, while Saul went to the city of Geba, taking with him only 600 men, along with his son Jonathan. Most of these had no weapons, since the country lacked iron and men able to forge weapons, for the Philistines did not allow this, as we have already explained a little earlier. The Philistines divided their army into three divisions and, advancing by as many roads, ravaged the country of the Hebrews, while Saul, their king, and his son Jonathan looked on, unable to defend the land, since they had only 600 men with them. Saul himself, his son, and the high priest Ahijah, a descendant of Eli the high priest, sat on a high hill, watching the land being plundered in a state of terrible anguish. Saul's son made a plan with his armor-bearer. They would go secretly to the enemy's camp, rush in, and cause confusion and panic among them. When the armor-bearer said he would eagerly follow wherever he led, even if it meant death, Jonathan, taking the young man's cooperation, went down from the hill toward the enemy. The enemy's camp lay on a cliff, surrounded by three peaks tapering to sharp points, a rocky ridge encircling it like a natural rampart, repelling any attack. Because of this, the camp's guards had grown careless, since the place itself seemed to guarantee its own safety, and everyone thought it impossible not only to climb up, but even to approach it. When they reached the camp, Jonathan encouraged his armor-bearer, saying, "Let us attack the enemy. If they tell us to come up to them when they see us, take that as a sign of victory. But if they say nothing, as though not calling us, let us turn back." As they approached the camp, with daylight already breaking, the Philistines saw them and said to one another that the Hebrews were coming out of their underground hiding places and caves, and they called out to Jonathan and his armor-bearer, "Come up here to us, so that we may punish you as your daring deserves." Saul's son, welcoming these words as a sign of victory for him, at once withdrew from the spot where the enemy had seen them, and passing by it, came to the cliff face, which was left unguarded because of its natural defenses. Climbing up from there with great effort, they forced their way up the difficult terrain to reach the enemy, and falling upon them while they slept, they killed about 20 men and filled the rest with confusion and panic, so that some fled, throwing away their armor, while most, unable to recognize one another, since the enemy force was made up of many different peoples, suspected each other, imagining that no more than two Hebrews had come up against them, and turned to fighting among themselves. Some of them died by each other's hands, while others, fleeing, were pushed off the cliffs and hurled down the rocks. When Saul's scouts reported to the king that the Philistine camp was in turmoil, Saul asked whether any of his own men were missing. Learning that his son and his armor-bearer were absent, he ordered the high priest to take the priestly vestments and prophesy to him about what was to come. When the high priest declared that there would be victory and mastery over the enemy, Saul marched out against the Philistines, who were now in confusion, attacked them, and they began killing one another. Those who had earlier fled into the underground passages and caves now streamed to join him when they heard that Saul was winning, and when the Hebrews numbered about 10,000, he pursued the enemy, now scattered across the whole countryside. Whether it was because of the joy of so unexpected a victory, for it commonly happens that men overcome by such good fortune lose control of their judgment, or because of ignorance, Saul now fell into a grave error, one that brought him much blame. Wanting to avenge himself and exact full punishment from the Philistines, he laid a curse on the Hebrews, that if anyone, instead of continuing to kill the enemy, stopped to eat before nightfall put an end to the slaughter and the pursuit of their enemies, that man would be accursed. When Saul had pronounced this, they came into a deep forest, full of bees, in the territory allotted to Ephraim, and Saul's son, who had not heard his father's curse or the people's assent to it, pressed out a bit of honeycomb and ate it. Only afterward did he learn that his father had forbidden, under a terrible curse, anyone to taste food before the son he stopped eating, but said that his father had not acted rightly. If the men had taken food while pursuing, they would have caught and killed far more of the enemy, with greater strength and greater eagerness. And indeed, after cutting down many tens of thousands of the Philistines, toward evening the army turned to plunder the Philistine camp, and having seized much booty and livestock, they slaughtered it and ate the meat with the blood still in it. This was reported to the king by the scribes, that the people were sinning against God, sacrificing and eating before the blood had been properly drained and the flesh made clean. So Saul ordered a great stone rolled into the middle of the camp and proclaimed that the people should slaughter their offerings upon it and not consume the meat together with the blood, for this was not pleasing to God. When everyone had done as the king commanded, Saul set up an altar there and offered a whole burnt offering to God upon it, the first altar he built, wishing to lead the army at once against the enemy's camp to plunder what was in it before daybreak, and finding the soldiers in no way reluctant but showing great eagerness to do whatever he ordered, the king summoned the high priest Ahitab and bade him inquire whether God granted and permitted them to march against the enemy's camp and destroy those in it. But when the priest said that God was not answering, and not without cause, Saul said, "When we inquire, God gives us no reply. He who before this revealed everything to us of his own accord, even without our asking, and was quick to speak. There must be some hidden sin among us that is the cause of his silence. And I swear by him, even if it should be my own son Jonathan who has committed this sin, I will put him to death and thereby appease God, exactly as I would if the guilty man belonged to another and had nothing to do with me, and I were exacting justice on his account." When the people cried out that this should be done, he at once made everyone stand in one place, and he himself with his son stood apart, and he sought by lot to learn who was guilty. The lot fell, it seemed, on Jonathan. Questioned by his father as to what wrong he had done and what in his conduct he was conscious of having performed neither rightly nor piously, he said, "Nothing else, father, except that yesterday, unaware of your curse and your oath, I tasted some honeycomb while pursuing the enemy." Saul swore to kill him, and he honored the oath above the ties of birth and natural affection. But Jonathan was not dismayed by the threat of death, Bearing himself nobly and with high spirit, he said, I will not beg you to spare me, father. Death is sweetest to me when it comes for the sake of your piety and after so brilliant a victory, for it is the greatest consolation to leave the Hebrews masters of the Philistines. At this, the whole people grieved and shared his suffering, and swore that they would not stand by and let Jonathan, the author of the victory, be put to death. So they snatched him from his father's curse, and themselves offered prayers to God on the young man's behalf, that he might release him from his sin. Saul then returned to his own city, having destroyed about 60,000 of the enemy. He reigned prosperously, and by making war on the neighboring nations, he subdued the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Philistines, the Idumeans, the Amalekites, and the king of Soba. He had three sons, Jonathan, Jesus, and Melchizos, and two daughters, Merob and Michal. His general was the son of his uncle, Abner. That uncle was called Ner, and Ner and Kish, Saul's father, were brothers, sons of Abiel. Saul also had a great number of chariots and horsemen, and whomever he fought he departed from victorious. He raised the Hebrews to prosperity and greatness of good fortune, and made them more powerful than the other nations. And from among the young men, he made his bodyguard of those distinguished for stature and beauty. Samuel then came to Saul and said he had been sent to him by God, to remind him that God had preferred him above all others and appointed him king, and that for this reason he must obey and be submissive to him, since Saul held command over the nations, but God held command over him and over all things. He said God spoke as follows. Since the Amalekites did the Hebrews much harm in the wilderness, when they had come out of Egypt and were making their way to the land now theirs, I command you to punish the Amalekites in war, and having overpowered them, to leave none of them alive, but to go through every age, beginning with the women and infants, killing them, and to exact from them this vengeance for what they did to your forefathers. And to spare neither the beasts of burden nor the other livestock for your own use and possession, but to dedicate everything to God, and, in obedience to the commands of Moses, to blot out the very name of Amalek. Saul agreed to do what was commanded, and reckoning that obedience to God consisted not merely in undertaking the campaign against the Amalekites, but showed it still more by his readiness and speed, with no delay at all, he gathered his whole force, and numbering it at Gilgal, found the Israelites apart from the tribe of Judah to be about 400,000. For that tribe alone furnished 30,000 soldiers. Saul then invaded the territory of the Amalekites and set many ambushes and traps around the ravine, so that he might not only strike them down when they fought in the open, but also fall upon them unexpectedly along the roads and destroy them by encirclement. Joining battle with them, he routed the enemy and destroyed them all as they fled, pursuing them. When this campaign had proceeded according to God's prophecy, he attacked the cities of the Amalekites and took them, some by siege engines, some by tunneling mines and by building counterwalls outside, others by famine and thirst, and others by still other means, capturing them by force. And he proceeded to the slaughter of the women and infants, judging that in doing this he was committing nothing cruel or harsher than human nature allows. First, because he was doing it to enemies, and second, because it was by God's command, disobedience to which carried danger. He also took captive the king of the enemy, Agag, and marveling at the beauty and stature of his body, judged him worthy of being spared, no longer acting in accordance with God's will, but overcome by his own feeling and yielding out of pity, unseasonably, in a matter over which he had no safe authority. For God so hated the nation of the Amalekites that he commanded that not even the infants be spared, toward whom pity is most naturally felt by nature. Yet Saul spared their king, the leader responsible for the wrongs done to the Hebrews, from the fate God had decreed for the memory of what he had commanded, setting the enemy's beauty above it. The people shared in his wrongdoing as well, for they too spared the beasts of burden and the livestock, and carried them off as plunder, not keeping them for destruction as God had commanded, and they carried away the other goods and wealth, destroying only what was not worth the trouble of keeping. Having conquered, Saul destroyed all the enemies from Pelusium in Egypt as far as the Red Sea, sparing only the nation of the Sycamites, for these dwelt in the midst of the land of Midian. Before the battle he had sent word ordering them to withdraw, so that they might not share in the Amalekites' disaster, for being kin of Raguel, the father-in-law of Moses, they had reason to be spared. Saul then, as though he had disobeyed none of what the prophet had enjoined upon him when he was about to wage war against the Amalekites, but had carefully observed all of it, and having conquered the enemy, returned home rejoicing in his success. But God was displeased both at the sparing of the king of the Amalekites and at the plundering of the livestock by the people, since these things had been done without his consent. For he considered it a grave matter that, while it was by his power that they were winning and prevailing over their enemies, he himself should be despised and disobeyed, as though he were not even a human king. He therefore said he repented having appointed Saul king, since Saul did none of what he commanded, but acted according to his own will. Hearing this, Samuel was greatly troubled, and throughout the whole night, he began to entreat God to be reconciled with Saul and not remain angry with him. But God would not grant the prophet's request for pardon on Saul's behalf, reckoning it unjust to forgive sins through mere entreaty. For nothing gives rise to wrongdoing more than the leniency shown toward wrongdoers, since in seeking a reputation for fairness and kindness men fail to notice that they are thereby breeding it. So, since God refused the prophet's plea and was clearly resolved not to relent, at daybreak Samuel came to Saul at Gilgal. Seeing him, the king ran to meet him, and embracing him said, "I thank God for giving me the victory. Everything he commanded has indeed been carried out." But Samuel replied, "Then where does this bleating of sheep and lowing of cattle in the camp come from?" He answered that the people had kept these for sacrifices, but that the whole race of the Amalekites had been wiped out according to the command, with no one else left, and that he had brought back only their king alive, about whom he said they would deliberate together as to what should be done. The prophet said that the divine is not pleased by sacrifices, but by good and just men, those who follow his will and his commands and consider nothing else to be done rightly by themselves except what they do at God's bidding. For God is despised not when one fails to sacrifice to him, but when one appears disobedient. From those who do not submit to him, nor practice the true worship alone pleasing to God, he accepts nothing gladly even if they slaughter many fat victims or offer a wealth of dedications made of silver and gold, but turns away and regards these as tokens of wickedness, not piety. But those who keep in mind this one thing alone, whatever God utters and commands, and who choose to die rather than transgress any of it, in these he delights, and he seeks no sacrifice from them, and from those who do sacrifice, even if their offering is meager, he receives the honor of poverty more gladly than that of the very wealthy. You, then, know that you are the object of God's anger, for you have despised and neglected what he commanded. How then do you suppose he would look upon a sacrifice offered from what he condemned to destruction? Unless you think that offering these things to God is no different from destroying them. Expect, then, to be stripped of the kingship and the authority, since, though you owe your position to the God who gave it to you, you have shown him such neglect. Saul admitted he had done wrong and did not deny his sin, that he had transgressed the prophet's commands, but said it was out of fear and dread of the soldiers that he had not prevented them from plundering the spoil or restrained them. But forgive me and be gentle, for I will guard against sinning in this way in the future. And he begged the prophet to turn back and offer a thank offering to God. But Samuel, since he did not see that God was reconciled, was leaving to go on his own way. Saul, wishing to hold him back, seized his cloak, and as Samuel pulled away with force to depart, the garment was torn. The prophet declared that in just this way his kingship would be torn from him, and that another, good and just, would receive it. For God abides by his judgments concerning a man, since it is a human failing, not a mark of divine power, to change and alter one's mind. Saul said he admitted he had acted impiously, but that what had been done could not be made undone. Still, he asked to be honored in the sight of the people by having Samuel come with him and worship God together with him. Samuel granted him this, and going with him worshiped God. Then the king of the Amalekites, Agag, was brought before him, and when he asked how bitter death could be, Samuel said, "Just as you made many Hebrew mothers grieve and mourn over their children, so you will cause your own mother to grieve over your destruction." And he ordered him put to death at once, at Gilgal. Samuel himself then departed for the city of Armathan. King Saul, perceiving what evils he had brought upon himself by making God his enemy, went up to his royal residence at Gaba. The name means hill when translated. And after that day, he no longer came before the prophet. And to Samuel, who was grieving over him, God commanded that he cease his concern, and instead take the holy oil and go to the city of Bethlehem, to Jesse the son of Obed, and anoint whichever of his sons God himself should point out as the one destined to become king. Samuel said he was afraid that Saul, learning of this, might kill him, whether by ambush or openly. But God instructed him and gave him a safe way to proceed, and he came to the city just named. Everyone there greeted him and asked the reason for his coming, and he said he had come to sacrifice to God. Having performed the sacrifice, he called Jesse together with his children to the sacred rites, and seeing his eldest son, who was tall and handsome, he judged from his fine appearance that this must be the one destined to be king. But he was mistaken about God's providence, for when he asked God whether he should anoint with the oil this young man whom he himself admired and judged worthy of the kingship, God said that men and God do not see the same things. You, looking at the young man's beauty, think him worthy to be king. But I do not make bodily comeliness the prize of kingship, but the virtue of souls, and I seek one who is perfectly fitted for this, in piety and righteousness. Courage and persuasiveness, the qualities that make up the beauty of the soul. When God had said this, Samuel ordered Jesse to bring forward all his sons before him. Jesse had five others come. The eldest was Taliabos, the second Aminadabos, the third Samalos, the fourth Nathanael, the fifth was called Ralos, and the sixth Asamos. The prophet, seeing that these two were no less handsome in form than the eldest, asked God which of them he chose as king. When God said none of them, Samuel asked Jesse whether he had any other sons besides these. Jesse answered that there was one named David, who tended the flocks and looked after their safe keeping, and Samuel ordered him summoned at once, for it was not possible for them to sit down to the feast until he was present. When David arrived, sent for by his father, he proved to be a boy fair-skinned, bright-eyed, and handsome besides. Samuel, saying quietly to himself that this was the one who had pleased God to be king, reclined at table himself, and set the young man to recline beside him, along with Jesse and the rest of the sons. Then, while David watched, he took the oil and anointed him, and spoke softly into his ear, signifying that God had chosen him to be king. He urged him to be just and obedient to God's commands, for in that way his kingdom would remain his for a long time, and his house would become splendid and celebrated. He would also overthrow the Philistines, and against whatever nations he made war he would win and, surviving the battle, would gain a glory sung for ages, both in his lifetime and to leave to those after him. Having given this counsel, Samuel departed, and the divine spirit passed over from Saul to David. David began to prophesy as the divine spirit made its home in him, while Saul was beset by certain afflictions and demonic torments that brought him chokings and stranglings, so that the physicians could think of no other treatment for him except that, if there were anyone able to sing charms and play the lyre, they should seek him out. And whenever the demons came upon Saul and threw him into confusion, this man should stand over his head, play, and sing hymns. Saul did not neglect this, but ordered that such a man be sought. Someone among those present said that he had seen in the city of Bethlehem a son of Jesse, still a boy in age, but handsome and fair, worthy of note in other respects as well, and moreover skilled at playing the lyre and singing hymns, and an outstanding warrior. Saul sent to Jesse and ordered him to send David to him, taking him away from the flocks, for he wished to see him, having heard of his good looks and his courage. Jesse sent his son, giving him gifts to bring to Saul. When David arrived, Saul was delighted with him, made him his armor-bearer, and held him in every honor, for he was charmed by him, and whenever the disturbance from the demons came upon him, David alone was his physician, singing hymns and playing the lyre and making Saul himself again. Saul then sent to the boy's father Jesse, asking him to let David remain with him, for he took pleasure in seeing him and having him near. Jesse did not refuse Saul, but consented to let him keep David. Not long afterward, the Philistines again gathered together, mustered a great force, and advanced against the Israelites, and encamping between Sacho and Azekah, they pitched camp. Saul led out his army against them, and, encamping on a certain mountain, forced the Philistines to abandon their first camp, and instead pitch camp on another mountain opposite the one Saul had occupied. A valley lay between the two mountains, separating the camps from each other. Then a man came down from the Philistine camp named Goliath, from the city of Gath, a man of enormous size, for he was 4 cubits and a span tall, wearing armor to match the size of his body. He wore a breastplate weighing 5,000 shekels, and a bronze helmet and greaves such as befitted a man of such extraordinary stature. His spear was no light burden for a right hand to carry, but he bore it lifted up on his shoulders, and he also had a javelin weighing 600 shekels. Many followed him carrying his weapons. This Goliath, standing between the battle lines, let out a great shout and said to Saul and the Hebrews, "I free you from battle and its dangers. Why should our armies clash and suffer? Give me one of your men to fight me, and let the outcome of the war be decided by the one who wins. Those on the losing side will be slaves to the other, whoever proves victorious. It is far better and wiser to gain what you want by the risk of one man than by that of all." Having said this, he withdrew to his own camp. The next day he came again and made the same speech, and for 40 days he did not stop challenging the enemy with the same words, until Saul himself and his army were struck with dread. They drew up in order as if for battle, but did not come to close quarters. While this war between the Hebrews and the Philistines was underway, Saul sent David back to his father Jesse, being content with Jesse's 3 sons whom he had sent to serve in the war and share its dangers. David at first went back to the flocks and the pastures where the animals grazed, but not long after he came to the camp of the Hebrews, sent by his father to bring provisions to his brothers and to learn how they were faring. When Goliath came forward again, issuing his challenge and taunting them that there was no man among them brave enough to come down and fight him, David, who happened to be talking with his brothers about the errand his father had sent him on, heard the Philistine blaspheming and reviling the army and grew indignant. He said to his brothers that he was ready to fight the enemy in single combat. At this, the eldest of the brothers, Eliab, rebuked him for being bolder than his age allowed and ignorant of what was fitting, and ordered him to go back to the flocks and to their father. Ashamed before his brother, David withdrew, but he spoke privately to some of the soldiers, saying that he wished to fight the challenger. When they immediately reported the young man's intention to Saul, the king sent for him, and when he asked what he meant to say, David answered, "Let your spirit not be humbled or timid, O king, for I will bring down the arrogance of this enemy by going out to meet him in battle and throwing down this tall, huge man beneath me. He himself will thereby become a laughingstock, but your army will gain glory, if he should die not at the hand of a man already capable of war and trusted with battle lines and combat, but at the hand of one who still seems a boy and is of this age." Saul, marveling at his boldness and courage, but not confident in him because of his youth, said that on account of his age he would be too weak to fight a man skilled in war. David replied, "I make this promise trusting in God who is with me, for I have already tested his help. Once, when a lion attacked my flocks and seized a lamb, I pursued and caught it, snatched the lamb from the mouth of the beast, and when it turned and charged at me, I seized it by the tail, dashed it to the ground, and killed it. I have done the same defending against a bear as well.